Hello there, and welcome back to Section 11, Immune Function. My name's Dr. Dickon Weatherby from Optimal DX and the ODX Academy, welcoming you to this section where we're going to be talking about the functional blood chemistry analysis and immune dysfunction. So we'll be looking at the chem screen and the CBC test, as well as some other functional diagnostic medicine assessment methodologies to get to the true cause of what's happening in our patients' immune systems. So one of the main ways to improve immune function is to identify and remove the stressors that impact the immune system and to strengthen the weaknesses. So one of the first things you must do to improve immune function is to build on the foundations of what you've already learned in this training program. Assess and treat GI dysfunctions first, because so much of the immune system resides in the GI tract. You must also identify and remove the stressors that impact the immune system and strengthen the weaknesses. But the importance of GI health to the immune system cannot be overemphasized. Methods of optimizing gut function may be just as important to the immune system as immune-supporting protocols. Supplementation with HCL and digestive enzymes may be just as effective for optimizing immunity as, say, supplementing with thymus extract or zinc. And this goes back to an old naturopathic saying, support the gut first. This has been true for over a century, and in the last 10 to 20 years, more and more research is coming out to support this. So you can improve immune function by always addressing the following first. Start by optimizing GI function. What does that mean? Optimal stomach acid secretion. Heal the gastric mucosa and get rid of H. pylori. Optimize pancreatic enzyme secretions. Optimize bile secretions. Optimize gut flora balance. Optimize mucosal barrier integrity. Optimize secretory IgA levels. And optimize bowel excretion. Next, optimize digestion and absorption of all nutrients. So this is beginning to look a little bit like our training program here, right? So in sections 1 and 2, we talked about the GI and the liver. Section 4 and 5, we talked about nutrients. So what nutrients are we talking about here? We're talking about minerals, we're talking about vitamins, we're talking about essential fatty acids, and we're talking about accessory nutrients. Optimize blood sugar regulation, extremely important. And finally, optimize neuroendocrine function, be it thyroid, be it adrenal, be it anterior pituitary, be it sex hormones. Very, very important that we do that. All right, now let's just jump into our signs and symptoms analysis. So we'll start with ways that you can use what I call the primary FDM assessment techniques to gather vital information on the immune system. So this starts by identifying parts of a patient's story that relate to immune system dysfunction. Top of the list here, runny or drippy nose. So a runny or drippy nose may be a sign of chronic sinusitis. Sinusitis can be traced to functional disturbances in the GI system that leads to antibody antigen complexes in systemic circulation. These produce the symptoms of allergies that can cause asthma and a stuffy nose. Sinus infections, I think, are a reflection of the dysbiosis in both the small intestine and, more importantly, the sinuses themselves. See, we can have dysbiosis in areas what Dr. Dick Tom called blind pouches. So it could be the gallbladder, could be the appendix, could be the cecum, and could be the sinuses. So new research has linked a chronic fungal infection with chronic sinus infections. Many people with chronic sinus infections have had numerous courses of antibiotics to treat the infection with no success. So this can also contribute to the dysbiosis in the small intestine. Treatment therefore needs to address the underlying cause by thoroughly assessing the GI system and beginning therapy to restore a healthy gut function. So a long-winded explanation. The reason why I chose this one was to kind of give you a sense of what's happening underneath that could be causing this particular symptom. Catching colds at the beginning of the winter. This is a great question to ask people. What's your immune system like at the beginning of the winter? Mucus-producing cough, frequent infections, so this could be ear, sinus, lung, skin, bladder, kidney. Any time that patients are reporting lots of infections in those particular areas, think that their immune system is affected. Frequent colds or flus, itchy ears could be a sign of zinc deficiency, acne, skin infections, itchy skin, dermatitis, cysts, boils, and rashes, history of chronic viral conditions. So that would be things like Epstein-Barr virus, mononucleosis, herpes, shingles, chronic fatigue, hepatitis. Ask your patients about these history of chronic viral conditions. So these are the signs and symptoms of immune system dysfunction. Let's take a quick look at our nutritional physical. So on the nutritional physical, you're going to want to pay attention for signs of eczema. You're wanting to ask your patients about itchy ears. Look for white matter on the tympanic membrane. That's a sign of candida. Ask about follicular hyperkeratosis, or even you can feel it in the upper arms. It's kind of like that sandpaper feeling on the upper arms. There could be vitamin A and zinc deficiencies. Slow wound healing, there could be a zinc deficiency. Hangnails, cuticle inflammation, again, zinc deficiency. White spots on the fingernails, conjunctivitis and that sort of thing. We'll go through some slides later on where we can kind of look at some of these things as well. So findings on a blood chemistry analysis are immune function score. We mentioned this in the biomarkers section, but I wanted to give a repeat of this because we're now in our assessment section. So this is a really good way of getting a sense of whether or not someone's immune system is functioning optimally, whether or not a patient is in an acute or chronic infection or has an immune insufficiency. So we set up the immune function score in the application and on the functional health report to give us a sense about that. So we're looking at total white blood cell count, we're looking at neutrophil percent and absolute, we're looking at lymphocytes percent and absolute, we're looking at globulins, we're looking at monocyte percent and absolute, we're looking at albumin, alkaline phosphatase, and bands. Here's what it looks like in the functional health report. So a high reading in the immune function score indicates that there is a dysfunction within your patient's immune system. This person's score is 96%. There's quite a lot going on here that is above or below the optimum ranges. So some of the factors to consider include immune insufficiency, chronic or acute bacterial infections, chronic or acute viral infections. So we may also want to tie this in with some GI dysfunction stuff, abnormal mucosal barrier function, secretory IgA dysfunction, or even dysbiosis. So now it's time to take a look at the different immune dysfunctions. Most of these are in the clinical implications report in the ODX application. So with immune insufficiency, we're looking for a decreased albumin level below 4 or below 40 grams per liter. This is associated with an immune insufficiency. We're also going to see a decreased total globulin level, often below 2 or below 20, so that's below the standard reference range. This is also suggestive of immune insufficiency. So suspect an increased use of globulins by the liver, the spleen, the thymus, the kidneys, or the heart. Rule out chronic immune disruptors, viruses, xenobiotics, toxicities. And consider that you might want to run a serum protein electrophoresis. And what you're going to want to look for on that is a decreased gamma fraction. So this will also help in our investigation of immune insufficiency. In terms of the total white blood cell count, see that below 5.5, another sign of immune insufficiency. A significantly increased or decreased total white blood cell count is justification to conduct further immune testing. So what would that look like? T and B lymphocyte subset assays, immunoglobulin, C-reactive protein, and that type of thing. And you're also, with immune insufficiency, will see a decreased alkaline phosphatase. Also, immune activation. This is kind of where the body's immune system is being switched on, usually in response to something. We're going to see a total globulin level above 2.8 or 28 grams per liter. This constitutes the body's antibody system. Globulins are composed of four fractions, alpha 1, alpha 2, beta, and gamma globulin. An increased level of total globulins above 2.8 or 28 grams per liter can therefore indicate an increase in one or more of those fractions that has been activated due to an infectious or inflammatory process. If you're seeing it above the standard range, which I think is about 3.2 or 32 grams per liter, consider again running that protein electrophoresis to see which of those four constituent fractions might be elevated. And that can kind of give you a clue as to what might be the cause of the infectious or inflammatory process that is increasing the total globulin level. You will also see a decreased albumin-globulin ratio. Thymus abnormality, we've talked about the thymus in our initial presentation on the functional physiology. Here's a simple pattern for thymus abnormality. Typically, it's an elevated bilirubin above 1.2 or 20.5 micromoles per deciliter. And with that, you're going to see an increase in the hemoglobin, the hematocrit, and the red blood cell count. So remember here that an increase in these three, hemoglobin, hematocrit, and red blood cells, are also indicative of dehydration and a sign of hemoconcentration. So you might want to check the albumin levels. If the albumin level is increased above 5, dehydration is one of the only causes of an increased albumin level. Also look for an increased BUN, an increased potassium, and an increased sodium level. If those are all increased and the hydration status score is very high, then you're probably looking at dehydration as potentially a cause for this and not necessarily a thymus abnormality. Some of the signs and symptoms of a thymus abnormality: delayed healing time. It's going to cause an immune insufficiency, frequent colds and flus, chemical sensitivities, and things like that. We're going to take a look here at zinc. Plays a very big role in immune function in the body. Some of the signs and symptoms that we looked at, where we looked at slow wound healing, white spots on the fingernails, cuticle inflammation, those are all zinc deficiency signs. So the role that zinc plays in the immune system is very, very important. And here are some of the roles that it does play. It promotes the destruction of antigenic material. It protects against free radical damage. It acts synergistically with vitamin A, which we know is an important immune nutrient. It's required for proper white blood cell function. It has antiviral properties by inhibiting viruses. It is a necessary cofactor for activating serum thymic factor, and is also an essential nutrient for cell-mediated and generalized host defense. So zinc deficiency is therefore a common finding in immune deficiency. So use the chem screen, use serum zinc, use alkaline phosphatase to check for zinc status. I know we've covered this in the deficiencies section. So here is our pattern for zinc deficiency and insufficiency. You will see decreased levels of alkaline phosphatase below 70. This has been associated with zinc deficiency. Serum zinc will be below 80 micrograms per deciliter or below 12 micromoles per liter. And you will see red blood cell zinc levels decreased as well. Alongside this, because of zinc's role in white blood cell function, you will see a low normal or decreased total white blood cell count below 5. If you're going to do in-office type testing, why not follow up with a zinc taste test? I covered this in the nutrient section, so if you want to go back to section 5, watch the video on that. But it's a great little test that you can do in the office to assess for zinc, and great for following up with a treatment as well. So look at some of our blood patterns for infections. We're going to kick off here with our acute bacterial infection pattern. So neutrophils are the primary cell type for fighting bacterial infections. So the neutrophil percent count will tend to be increased above 60, along with an increased absolute count above 4.2. They both don't have to be increased here. So this is indicating a elevated neutrophil count. Expect percent lymphocytes to be decreased below 24%, but maybe normal. You also are going to expect that the total white blood cell count will be elevated above 7.5, and an increase in the bands. Remember, bands are the young, non-segmented neutrophils, or what are called metamyelocytes, that occur with acute infections, with or without an absolute increase in the total white blood cell. This is known as a shift to the left. The presence of bands can help determine the timing or the severity of an infection. They will increase in active infection and normalize in the recovery process. The presence of bands in a bacterial infection can often be a good prognosis. So in summary, an increased neutrophil percent above 60%, along with an increased neutrophil count above 4.2, and normal lymphocytes, or maybe slightly increased lymphocytes, slightly decreased lymphocyte percent, this is the classic sign of an acute bacterial infection. All right, let's take a look at our patterns here for the childhood illnesses. So this is the measles, the mumps, the chickenpox, and the rubella. Now, I know we're not seeing a lot of these in clinical practice, but I'm kind of bringing these in as sort of an example of sort of the classic presentation of what happens to neutrophils and lymphocytes early in infections and later infections. So we're going to pay attention here to neutrophils and lymphocytes. Early in the infection of measles, mumps, chickenpox, rubella, etc., neutrophils are going to be increased. You're going to see an increase in the percentage count to above 60, and the absolute count will be above 4.2. Conversely, your lymphocyte count will be decreased below 24% for our percentage value and below 0.95 in our absolute. Now, later in the infection, we're going to see a switchover. The neutrophils will start to decrease, so you're going to get your percentage value below 40 as the lymphocyte levels start to increase. Your absolute count will drop below 1.9. Lymphocytes, on the other hand, are going to start to increase. You're going to start seeing percentage value. So that's kind of the ratios between lymphocytes and neutrophils are going to be above 44%, and your absolute count will be above 3.1. What about chronic bacterial infections? So you're going to see an increased neutrophil percent above 60%, but you're also going to see a decreased white blood cell count below 5.5. And then a chronic infection of unknown cause, i.e. not sure if it is a bacteria or a virus, can use up a large number of lymphocytes, which may actually be decreased. So you're going to see that percentage value of lymphocytes decreasing to 24%. In the recovery phase of a chronic bacterial infection, because we're progressing into more so chronicity, you might see an increased monocyte. This is a good thing, above 7.7%. This is marked as part of the recovery phase. All right, what about acute viral infection? So this may be Epstein-Barr, it may be mono, hepatitis, cytomegalovirus, or any viral infection, including colds and flus. Your lymphocyte percent will be increased above 44%, along with an increased lymphocyte count above 3.1. You're also going to have an increased total white count above 7.5. So in viral diseases such as upper respiratory infections, cytomegalovirus, infectious hepatitis, toxoplasmosis, and that type of thing. You will also see a possibly increased ESR above 5 in men and above 10 in women. And you may see a possible increase in the LDH above 200. So LDH levels are usually elevated in about 95% of cases of infectious mononucleosis and Epstein-Barr infection. LDH is usually elevated in cytomegalovirus virus, and other values usually take time to increase. Expect to see decreased or normal neutrophils, percent count below 40, and our neutrophil count below 1.9. So you may expect to see the following changes: a decrease in the white blood cell counts in the first week, increased white blood cell count in the second week, increased alkaline phosphatase, increasing AST. This is going to be about 5 to 14 days after the onset of illness, and an increased GGT about 7 to 21 days after the onset of illness as well. So chronic viral infection, you're going to see the increasing in those lymphocytes, so the percent count will be above 44%. Absolute count will be above 3.1, but just the same way with a chronic bacterial infection, your decrease will happen in the total white blood cell count. Expect to see a decreased neutrophil percent below 40 and or absolute count will be below 1.9. You may see a decreased lymphocyte percent and or absolute count in very chronic infections. Our recovery phase of infections, monocyte percent will often be elevated above 7 along with an increased monocyte count, 0.95. in the recovery phase of an infection. And this can be used to follow the course of an infection as well. Remember, monocytes are phagocytic cells that are capable of movement. They remove dead cells, they remove microorganisms, they remove particulate matter from circulating blood. So during the infectious process, the monocyte level will increase after about 3 days to start phagocytizing fragments of neutrophils. Monocytes also produce the antiviral agent interferon. It is a positive sign to see an increase in monocytes towards the end of an infection. What about infectious mononucleosis? So this is a disease caused by Epstein-Barr. It is most common in adolescents and young adults. It is characterized by an increase in your lymphocyte percent, and you're going to see a very increased lymphocyte count, often as high as 10.5. It is characterized by an increase in the presence of what are called Downy cells or atypical lymphocytes. LDH levels were usually elevated in about 95% of cases. You will see a decreased white count in the first week, but an increased white count in the second week, and expect to see an increase in alkaline phosphatase and AST, and an increase in GGT as well, along with our infectious mononucleosis. Relative lymphocytosis. So a lymphocytosis equals a lymphocyte count, absolute count, above 4. This finding, along with a greatly elevated total white blood cell count and very low neutrophils, may suggest a need for further investigation into acute and chronic lymphatic leukemia lymphoma. All right, let's move on now. Take a look at allergies, sensitivities, and intolerances. All right, so here are some of the miscellaneous symptoms of food allergies. Everything from arrhythmias, edema, fainting, fatigue, headaches, hyperglycemia, itchy nose or throat, migraines, sinusitis, dizziness, canker sores, constipation, hemorrhoids, hypertension, gallbladder pain, colitis, and weight gain. So a ton of symptoms associated with food allergies. So here is some of the relationships in terms of the systems of the body. So for instance, in the GI, canker sores, celiac disease, chronic diarrhea, duodenal ulcers, gastritis, IBS, malabsorption, and ulcerative colitis can all be symptoms related to food allergies that are affecting the GI system. So I kind of leave this up to you to kind of take a look at and use for your references. The nutritional exam findings. So we're going to run through some of these. I'm going to show you some of these pictures. So the ones that are highlighted, we've got a little bit further information on. So ultimately, adult acne and acne rosacea are findings for allergies. Scars on the tympanic membrane, I'll go through those in a few minutes. Acne rosacea is a sign of hypochlorhydria and allergies. Scars on the tympanic membrane due to tubes. These could be allergies, especially to milk. Generalized itching, discoloration of the nails, dark circles under the eyes. We'll take a look at those in a few minutes as well. That's known as allergic shiners. So let's take a look here at the tympanic membrane. So I'm not sure if many of you are actually doing otoscopic examinations, but I wanted to kind of run through some of these because acute otitis media is definitely something that you will see in practice, and you will want to know how to A, identify it, and then B, kind of deal with it. So the normal tympanic membrane, this is the normal tympanic membrane here, is thin and semi-transparent. When you're looking at it through an otoscope, it has a pearly gray appearance. You're actually going to see some structures potentially in the middle ear, such as the long process of the incus and the opening of the eustachian tube. The handle of the malleolus is this, which extends down and backwards, is a reliable landmark. This is a tympanic membrane with wax or cerumen. This is a normal secretion. As the wax accumulates, it hardens and has this sort of darkening color here. Number three here, we're beginning to look at acute otitis media or middle ear infection. There's a distortion of the drum. You're going to see prominent blood vessels in the upper half with dullness on the lower half. There's also bulging of the upper half of the drum as well. This one here is a further example with no recognizable landmarks. I would say this is probably more chronic. It's been going on for a while. Considerable bulging in the eardrum here. You can see down here even further. Number six here, appearance of serous or secretory otitis media. The eardrum has lost its luster, and an effusion is visible through the eardrum with a fluid meniscus defining the upper margins. Number seven here, fluid behind the ear in an asymptomatic child. Effusion is visible with a fluid level in the lower half of the eardrum. So you can see that, that's the fluid building up in the ear. This is a resolution of mild middle ear effusion. This is a further view of serous otitis media. What else we got? We got tympanosclerosis. Basically, that is where we have otitis media healing, and we get an inflammatory process here in the middle ear. This is a central perforation of the eardrum. I've seen this a few times in practice where parents have kind of not wanted to bring their child in. And when they did, they noticed there was a massive loss of fluid out of the ear, and they brought him in and we did an otoscopy examination and saw that there was a perforation in the eardrum. This will heal, but ultimately you don't want this to happen too often because you're going to start to get scarring in there. But this one here is the grommet. This is the tympanostomy tube. These are grommets inserted into the tympanic membrane in order to drain that middle ear effusion. So having a good sense of what the eardrum looks like, if you're seeing the scarring, if you're seeing evidence that there's been these grommets put into the ears, know that this child has probably had a long-standing run-in with acute otitis media, and that is not a good sign. It's a sign of allergies. It's a sign potentially of a dairy allergy. So the first thing I would do with kids that are having acute middle ear infection would be to take them off of dairy. Going back to our nutritional exam findings, let's take a look here at dark circles under the eyes. This is called allergic shiners. So anytime you're seeing these dark circles under the eyes in our kids, this is due to swelling of the tissue. We've got pressure on the veins and pooling of the blood due to allergies, venous congestion, and that sort of thing. So you want to make sure that this kid here is, you're looking out for their food allergies and things like that. Conjunctivitis, recurrent styes. If you haven't seen these before, these are like little bumps here on the eyes. You've got conjunctivitis where the reddening of the conjunctiva is inflamed. So again, these are all signs of inflammation and also problems with allergies. If you're going to look inside the nose, you're going to see sores inside the nose. If you can imagine someone's got allergies and a lot of mucosal inflammation in their nose, they could end up being actually quite sore inside. So take a peek with your otoscope, look up at the nose and see the tissue up there. The salute sign, this is a horizontal line across the bridge of the nose, kind of a classic allergy sign. Intranasal polyps, another sign for allergies. Red rash over the nose and under the eyes, again, allergies. And then geographic tongue and scallop tongue. So these are both issues to do with allergies as well. On the left is a picture of a scalloped tongue. In Western medicine, not considered to be a symptom of a swollen tongue, such that the tongue pushes against the teeth. If you're reading Western medical literature, there really isn't much that they put as to the cause of this. In Chinese medicine, this is most often seen as a sign of qi deficiency, particularly of the spleen, can be a result of long-standing overthinking or worry, often known as student tongue, because of the many hours that students spend studying or worrying about test results. Consider fatigue, digestive issues, will be some of the top symptoms that you'll think about with scalloped tongue. Geographic tongue here, inflammatory condition of the mucous membrane of the tongue. In Western allopathic medicine, the cause is unknown, but it is an inflammatory sign, possibly increased with stress, with allergies, blood sugar issues, and hormonal disturbances. So those are some of the nutritional physical findings for allergies that we should be paying attention to. I want to finish here with a little thing called allergic tension. So allergic tension is a phenomenon first described by the noted Spanish allergist, Dr. B. Sanchez Huanca. He discovered that if your pulse count taken standing is greater than that taken sitting, this is a positive indication of an irritable state of the tissues. And Dr. Sanchez Huanca named this allergic tension. So how do you do this? Well, you take a full 1 minute pulse sitting, then you stand and wait 15 seconds and take another full minute pulse. If the standing pulse goes up by more than 6 beats, this is an indication of allergic tension or that the body is under an allergenic burden. Really nice little test to do in the office. Also, you can have your patients do this as well. Like a nice little lead in to our COCA pulse testing, which is our special topic towards the end of this section. Asthma, you're going to see an increased eosinophil absolute count. You'll also see an increased eosinophil percent above 3%. This is often seen in asthma. This is due to the connection between allergies and asthma. So a digestive stool analysis will frequently indicate dysbiosis in an asthmatic, and a liver detox panel will often indicate liver dysfunction. Here is our pattern here for allergies. So these are the following findings on a CBC. These are associated with food allergies and or sensitivities. So again, we're going to be looking at eosinophils and basophils. So an increased eosinophil absolute count above 0.3, increased eosinophil percent above 3, increased basophil absolute count above 0.1, and an increased basophil percent above 1. So let's talk about eosinophils. Eosinophils are often increased in patients that are suffering from food or environmental sensitivities and allergens. Eosinophils will help remove and break down the byproducts of protein catabolism. They have the ability to ingest antibody antigen complexes and become active in later stages of inflammation. Not effective against bacteria, but do respond to allergic disorders. So anytime you see the absolute count or percent of eosinophils get high, consider that allergies is probably an issue going on here. As I've mentioned before, basophils are phagocytic. They contain histamine, heparin, and serotonin in cytoplasmic granules. They can exist in the blood and in the tissues. And in the tissues, they are known as mast cells. So basophils play an important role in the inflammatory process by releasing heparin and other substances to prevent clotting in the inflamed tissues. Basophils will often be increased with both tissue inflammation, but they are associated with allergies. So in summary, an increased eosinophil and basophil count is associated with allergies, food allergies, and or sensitivities. So there are a number of sophisticated and expensive tests for specific food allergies. These are often normal. In my experience, a weekly diet diary can be a very helpful tool to investigate possible food allergies and sensitivities. An elimination diet for 4 weeks and a subsequent challenge of suspect foods can help determine the most common foods that a patient is allergic or sensitive to. Foods that the patient may be sensitive to most often are dairy products, gluten-containing grains, citrus, shellfish, foods containing additives, and food dyes. There are several methods of food sensitivity testing available. Let's do a little quick run through of that. So in summary, there are basically two methods. You can do the food challenge method, or you can use laboratory testing. Each has its advantages. Food challenge is inexpensive, gives the patient a direct connection to the foods in question, can be helpful in identifying food intolerances. The downside is that it takes time, and patients oftentimes don't like doing it. So a lot of times they just want a lab test. Lab test method can provide an immediate identification but are expensive, and they will only give the food one is truly allergic to. The one thing you have to also remember about lab testing is that it doesn't really tell you whether or not we've got mucosal barrier function issues. If you've got issues in your GI, a lot of these food allergens are going to be passing through into general circulation. Therefore, deal with the food deal with the intestinal mucosal barrier function issues, and oftentimes the allergic foods will resolve themselves. In our final clinical presentation of this particular section, I'm going to do a special presentation on a food challenge method called COCA pulse testing. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you. So I covered a number of assessment methods to help you assess the state of the immune system and uncover underlying causes of the dysfunction. Really appreciate your participation. So this ends the 10 training sessions in the FBCA Mastery Training Program. As I just mentioned, I got one final bonus section on a technique I learned about a number of years ago called COCA pulse testing. Please do tune into that. It's a good little technique to use. It's not going to be on the quiz or the examination. It's just a special topic. Next session, session 12, is our final session. I'm going to show you kind of how to put it all together. I'm going to go over some cases to show you how I would go about the analysis and how to blend in some other functional diagnostic techniques to give a well-rounded assessment of patients' health and well-being. So until then, I hope you found this helpful and useful. This is Dr. Weatherby saying thanks for watching, and we'll be in touch soon.